How important is the outdoors, the wildness of Canada, to your image of the country? Chances are those vast, postcard-perfect landscapes are one of the first things that come to your mind. Now, how important are the outdoors to your own image of yourself? That probably depends on who you are and where you grew up and who you grew up thinking that wilderness was for. Stereotypes of who belongs out in the wilds of nature are as old as some of the trees themselves.
White people really need to stop asking black people to go camping. We don't want to go. On behalf of me and Tyrone here, we don't want to go.
Last year, Mountain Equipment Co-op, that iconic supplier of the gear we use to get out into nature, issued an unusual apology letter. It was not preceded by scandal, but it was titled, "Do White People Dominate the Outdoors?" And in the text, the company vowed to do better, to include people of color in its catalog and its advertising. The outdoors is, as Mountain Equipment said, for everyone, but not everyone feels that way until they take it upon themselves to change that. So today we're telling the story of the most Canadian of journeys, a trip straight across the country, BC to Newfoundland, cycling, camping, exploring, and how different that trip can be inside and out when you're black. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Philip Dwight Morgan is a writer who penned an essay on his epic trip for the book Black Writers Matter and also for The Walrus. So first of all, how essential do you think the image of nature and the wilderness is to like how we talk about ourselves as Canadians?
Well, I mean, it's quite central to the national identity. Regardless of, you know, whether or not one agrees with it, there are many people who sort of, it's part of our national mythology. Even if you look at our money, for example, there are animals and scenes of wilderness depicted on our currency.
It's pretty
vital, I think.
What about to black Canadians?
I can't speak on behalf of all black Canadians, but
Sure. Certainly
I know, you know, there are many black Canadians who grew up in, you know, rural communities in Nova Scotia, for example, and nature is, you know, fundamental to their understanding of the land and their interaction with that geography. For me, as someone growing up in Scarborough, nature wasn't a huge part of my childhood. And at the same time, as I got older and I connected with people who went on camping trips and things like that, it became very important to me.
Where does that kind of disconnect start for you? Where you didn't, obviously, you didn't grow up in rural Canada, but where were you first conscious of like not being connected to the same image of Canada that a lot of other people hold?
I think it was when I went away to university. I did my undergraduate degree at Trent University, and a lot of my friends there, you know, went on canoe trips, and their, you know, their whole lives were sort of structured around camping, canoeing, snowshoeing, that type of thing. And I'd had few, if any, experiences like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be in a space that was, you know, predominantly white and to have so many friends that were very familiar with nature, it was for me this moment where I thought, well, what's going on here? Why are my experiences so different than theirs? You know, we're all around the same age, but we have completely different experiences.
What were you feeling in those moments when they're discussing the kind of interactions with the wilderness that you don't have experience with? Do you want those, or were you conscious of just not having a framework for it?
I had kind of mixed feelings. I was curious, but then also I was kind of astounded by the sense of entitlement that a lot of folks had, or the sort of currency that spending time in the wilderness had, you know. So people were kind of like, oh my goodness, you've never gone canoeing before.
Yeah.
And there were all these sort of assumptions that flowed from that. And for me, it was kind of just like, okay, I don't get it. I've also never bobsleighed. I've never, like, you know, mm-hmm. it seems arbitrary the way that there was so much value assigned to canoeing as a form of Canadianness.
Right.
You know?
Do you remember the first time as a kid growing up in Scarborough, you noticed that there were activities and adventures out there that you weren't taking part in? Or do you not notice it till you get out further?
It's more when I got out further. I mean, the community that I grew up in Scarborough was mostly people of color,
mm-hmm.
Predominantly Sri Lankan and Chinese immigrants in that community. And so we would just hang out together and play soccer in the local park and do things like that. I did go to a church that did, you know, camping trips and things like that. And so I had a few experiences where, you know, I went on these camping trips and I was kind of just like, what is this? Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
But generally, it was really when I went to university that I noticed that gap in my experience, or the difference in experience.
What really fascinated me about your essay was kind of the way you took it upon yourself to confront that. So tell me what that looked like.
So that looked like a two-month trip across Canada, cycling with my friend Alex from Vancouver, British Columbia, to St. John's, Newfoundland.
So that's like 0 to 60. What on earth possessed you to go from feeling like you didn't have a place in the outdoors to be like, all right, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to bike across Canada.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is that it was 0 to 60 or 0 to 100 in terms of, you know, in terms of cycling, but I was getting much more involved in the outdoors. So, for several years, I was a rock climbing instructor, and there were just different things in my life that kind of led me to that point. But also part of it is just my personality. I'm someone that just, you know, throw me in the deep end, let's do this, let's go. And so once I found a co-conspirator in that, I was excited for the challenge and ready to go.
Tell me what that process is like to plan a trip like that and what you were faced with doing it.
I am forever indebted to Alex because he had a lot of the organizational prowess. You know, he showed up at my place and he said, all right, we're going to need to figure out how many kilometers we're doing every day. We're going to need to figure out food, accommodations, et cetera. So there were a lot of logistics involved. Part of what we did was we did our due diligence in terms of research. We got books out and things like that and just read up on other people who had done similar things and what were some of the things to watch out for, et cetera. But just a lot of logistics because you're on the road for 60 some odd days. And I had never done anything like that. So it's just a lot of planning.
Did you practice first?
I didn't. And it was...
How much of a cyclist were you before you got this idea into your head?
You know, I would cycle around the city and go from A to B. So I was a commuter cyclist.
Sure.
But I hadn't done any cycle touring or anything like that. Yeah, Alex had sort of warned me, you know, make sure you do at least a few trips of 100 kilometers. And I was like, yeah, sure, definitely. And then just never followed up on it. And then it came to bite me in the butt. The first few days were brutal. I have a pretty high tolerance for pain and discomfort, and I was just shocked by the magnitude of the task ahead of me and just how ill-prepared I was. The first few days, I really asked myself, you know, is this something that you can do? Maybe you bit off a bit too much. This is ambitious.
Did your image and connection with the wildness of Canada change as you were doing it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, I've spoken to enough friends who are, you know, who aren't experienced campers who have had a similar type of experience where the first few days are just mortifying. You know, you hear something rustling in the bushes and you think, oh my gosh, what is that? But after a while, you just sort of become acclimated and you settle in. And that's very much the process of what happened in cycling across Canada. The first few days, I was terrified. I was convinced that I was going to be, you know, killed by some sort of animal. And it sounds foolish now, but at the time, I genuinely thought that was what was going to happen. And then after about 2 weeks or so, I had really settled in. I was completely at ease being by myself.
Was there a moment when you realized that you were, I'm not going to say like one with nature or anything, but was there a moment that you realized like I'm in touch with this in a way that I wasn't before, that I wasn't brought up with?
I would push back on some of the language there, because I personally think that nature, you know, however you define it, is really sort of difficult to put a finger on. And if you become really sort of complacent, if you say, oh, you know, I'm one with nature or
right,
whatever, you can get hurt really easily. And I've had these experiences. You know, my partner and I were camping and had an encounter with a bear. I've done some rock climbing in the States where, you know, a poisonous snake popped out of a crack. Like there's any number of scenarios that I've been in where you kind of realize you can't get too comfortable in nature. So there always has to be like a sort of baseline respect there, I think.
Why did you seemingly, and correct me if I'm wrong, push yourself out of your comfort zone so much to learn to rock climb, to go camping, to do this insane bike trip? What was it there that made you? Because a lot of kids, black and white, grow up in the city and never make the effort to go that far with connecting with the wildness of Canada.
Again, I think it's something kind of unique about my personality in that I like a good challenge.
Yeah.
And I'm the kind of person that likes to sort of embrace the grind. As people say to me, you know, oh, that seems too extreme or you can't do that, that's all the more reason for me to try and do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to sort of hedge my answer a bit because there's a tremendous amount of privilege involved in being able to do a cross Canada bike trip.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's the time off, whether it's the physical fitness, whether it's the expense of it, because that's the other thing is people don't realize how expensive a trip like that is. They think, oh, you're just on your bike. You're, you know, it can't be that expensive. But I mean, just the amount of food we were eating, you know, burning thousands of calories per day, we must have spent $20, $30 a day on food. And that was just eating, you know, basic stuff, granola bars, sandwiches, whatever. So, you know, $30 a day times 30 days in a month, that's $900 a month just on food per person, not to mention all the other expenses. So,
right. Well, this is a good place to break it down into to the next segment then, because how much of this, and for urban kids especially, and maybe African Canadian kids as well, mm-hmm. is about access to ways to get in touch with the wilderness?
I mean, I think it varies from community to community. I had a friend who was running a music camp for youth, and they noticed that there weren't a lot of Black youth, and so they had their board meeting, and they said, well, is it because the camp is too expensive? Is that what's going on? And when I heard that this was the conversation, I said to her, you can't just make that assumption. Like, what you said just makes a lot of assumptions about Black people, and you're assuming that the barrier is an economic one.
Right.
Maybe it's a culture, maybe there's any number of variables. Certainly part of the conversation is the economic barriers exist, but also it's about places that are often hostile to Black people being in those spaces. You know, I've been to a couple of, you know, ski clubs or whatever, and sometimes they're very unfriendly places, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even if I had the financial means to be there, that's not a place that I would want to frequent because I didn't feel welcomed there.
And what about the image of, in popular culture, the sort of people who are out there exploring the wildness of Canada? I don't know if you followed last year, Mountain Equipment Co-op apologized mm-hmm. for its catalog, essentially, and the portrayal of who uses their products and it being almost exclusively white Canadians. And they've vowed to do better. But how much of that image filters all the way down to kids wondering if they should go camping or rock climbing or whatever?
It has a huge impact. So much of how we define ourselves as people is based on story and storytelling and narratives and myth. And so the fact that part of being Canadian is access to nature, and then that representation is almost exclusively depicted as being white, it creates this messaging that white people are the only people who belong in nature. At its sort of most extreme example, I think what this leads to is really problematic claims from white people about their entitlement to the land and their ownership of the land without any sort of recognition of, one, like, they're settlers to this land, two, there are other people, like, they are using the land, and there are other people who are, like, I just think about, it's a very extreme and very painful example, but I think about, you know, in the prairies, Colton Bushi and Gerald Stanley, and there's so many factors at play, so I don't want to reduce it just to narratives about land. But there is something in there about the fact that this white man thought that he was completely entitled to take the life of an indigenous boy because he was trespassing. I think that sort of speaks to the entitlement that a lot of white folks have to the land, which is rooted in narratives of we belong here, the great white north, we are Canadian, et cetera. All of that, it can become really harmful.
Did you feel any of that personally on your trip across Canada, that you were cycling through places where you didn't feel you had ownership of the land, that somebody else felt that way and you felt uncomfortable?
Well, it's funny because, so Alex read the Walrus piece. I hadn't shared it with him. And he said to me, I'm surprised you didn't write about that experience that we had in Alberta. I said, oh, wow. And it completely slipped my mind. By far the scariest night, scariest day of the trip was not, you know, when I almost stepped on a snake or when I was about 15 feet away from a moose or any of that. It was when we'd been biking through rural Alberta and we hadn't seen cars or really like many houses for miles. And so we stopped on the side of the road because the sun was going down and we said, okay, you know, we're just going to camp here for the night. Set up, we were cooking food, etc. And then about maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up to lights being shone on the tent and the sort of grumbling of a truck engine outside of the tent. And Alex was fully asleep, and I woke up, and I sat there for about 5 minutes wondering what was going on. And the whole time I just heard, and the car was just parked outside, light shining on the tent. I nudged Alex, and I said, something's going on. You've got to get up. And he's like, what? And I said, this car has been parked out here for 5 minutes. I can't go out there. I don't feel safe going out there. And so I said, you should go out there as a white guy. So he was putting his shoes on, getting ready to go out there. And right as he was about to unzip the tent, the truck just pulled away and drove off. And so to this day, I have no idea who those people were, what they wanted. I don't know anything about it, but I do know that it was one of the most terrifying moments of my life.
Wow. And so you have no idea what was going on, but...
No clue.
Yeah. How did you feel about that afterwards, and how did it make you feel about your relationship to the land you're passing through, right? Because this is all about how the ownership or the entitlement or even just the level of comfort people feel traveling through their country.
I mean, I felt scared, but also relieved that nothing had sort of come of it. You know, I've talked to Alex about it, you know, since, and for him, I think it was pretty eye-opening because, you know, for me to be terrified and to say to him, you need to go out there. Mm-hmm. And I think just a few things clicked for him. And there are a lot of things that people talk about, and it's only when you experience it that you're kind of like, oh, this is what all the conversations were about. Mm-hmm. And so I think the racism in Canada, the intensity of the entitlement that many folks feel over the land, it became palpable in that moment because this truck just showed up and parked right outside the tent and had no qualms about just, you know, hanging out there.
Yeah.
Didn't say a word, nothing. It was horrifying. And, you know, the whole time it was happening, Alex was fast asleep.
Yeah, and I could tell you, as a white guy, I'd feel perfectly comfortable getting up and walking out there being like, what do you want, guys?
Yeah, and I would never do that.
Yeah.
Never, ever, ever. I was horrified.
You finished the trip.
Yeah.
How long did it take you? Where did you end up?
I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think it was about 63 or so days of cycling. I think 65 or so days total, 66 maybe. We finished in St. John's, Newfoundland. I remember we stopped at a bar and we had a beer. And Alex is just such a charismatic person. And so he's like, hey, everybody, guess what? We just biked across Canada. And people in the bar were like, are you serious? I'm like, yeah. They're like, the whole way? Yeah, we started in Vancouver 2 months ago, and we got here. And people in the bar were like, get these boys some drinks.
Yeah.
we arrived, I think, around 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I remember going to bed at about 7 or 8 a.m. the next morning. It was just meeting lots of locals and just sharing stories and just celebrating.
Did you encounter surprise through your journey or at the end of your journey that a black guy was cycling across Canada? Because I won't lie, we talked this morning, our associate producer, Ryan Clark, who's black, and I told him about the story we were doing today, and I told him he cycled across Canada. He looked at me and said, are you sure he's black?
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing that I get all the time, like whether it's, you know, cycling across Canada or being a rock climbing instructor or camping or anything. They're like, these are not things that black people do. Like, what are you doing?
Right.
And even with my family's like, what is wrong with you? Where did you come from? You know, but this is why I think we need to have these kinds of conversations, is because there are lots of black folks who are into activities that are typically not seen as black, whether it's running, you know, ultra marathons, or whether it's rock climbing or whatever. I mean, certainly not in the same proportion as white folks. Like, right. Absolutely not. But there are black folks out there and people of color doing these things. I think when the barriers are removed, whether it's, again, sort of in the cultures of these places, you know, being hostile environments, or if it's economic barriers or whatever it may be, once those barriers are removed, you'll see even more people of color. Hockey is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, do black people even play hockey? Well, yeah, black people play hockey. Not in the same numbers as white folks, but there's any number of explanations as to why. But, you know, if black kids could just easily get a hockey stick and rink time and equipment, you'd see lots of black kids playing hockey. You know?
And it's also back to that image again, right? What it takes is PK Subban.
Exactly.
For black kids to see, not only can black kids play hockey, they can be great.
And that's the thing, too, is, you know, PK Subban has been very clear about... you know, the experiences that he's had, the barriers that he's faced, mm-hmm. even at the highest level of playing hockey, just all the racism that he's faced, despite being, you know, a premier elite player. This is the reality for a lot of people endeavoring to connect with the outdoors or to do these kinds of activities, is that you're going to face a lot of resistance. This is why in my piece I write about the jokes about, you know, why would you do this? Those are white people things, whatever. Those jokes kind of reinforce this idea that we don't belong there. You know, it just makes it that much harder to actually get out there. So I think it's important to show people of color, and specifically black folks, doing these things, biking across Canada, rock climbing, playing hockey, whatever it may be.
Thanks, Philip.
Thanks a lot.
Philip Dwight Morgan, author of Race, Privilege, and the Canadian Wilderness. And that was The Big Story. For more from us, we're at thebigstorypodcast.ca. We've got tons of episodes for you to listen to. We're also at frequencypodcastnetwork.com, and we have other shows for you there, too. We are on Twitter,
at The Big Story FPN and at Frequency Pods. And we are on Facebook at Frequency Pods too. You can find us wherever you get podcasts, on Apple, on Google, on Stitcher, on Spotify. And you can rate us and leave us a review. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Claire Brassard is our lead producer. Ryan Clark is our associate producer. And Stephanie Phillips is our intrepid research assistant. Thanks for listening. We are off for the long weekend. Happy Family Day. We'll talk to you Tuesday.